top stories, Moscow denounces what it calls U.S. peak hysteria surrounding Ukraine after President Biden warned of a decisive response to Russia invades, if Russia invades Ukraine. The United States says it will open an embassy in the Solomon Islands in a bid to push back against China in the Pacific. And truckers blocking a key bridge between Canada and the United States over vaccination rules defy orders to leave.
Welcome to the program.
Moscow denounces what it calls Washington's peak hysteria over Ukraine. It says warnings of an imminent Russian invasion on its western neighbor have reached absurd levels. This comes following a phone call between Russian and U.S. presidents where Joe Biden pledged a swift and direct response by the United States and its allies if Russia attacked Ukraine. Vladimir Putin also criticized the U.S. for failing to address his country's security concerns. Russia has repeatedly dismissed allegations that it is preparing to invade Ukraine. It has, however, demanded an end to NATO's eastward expansion and a ban on Kiev's admission to the military alliance. Meanwhile, Ukraine itself has denounced the hype about a looming Russian attack.
I have to speak with our people like like president and say people truth and the truth that we have different information. And now the best friend for enemies, that is panic in our country. And all this information that helps only for panic doesn't help us.
Zelensky also demanded any solid evidence of an imminent invasion. Several countries, including the U.S., the U.K., Germany, Sweden, Japan, and Saudi Arabia, have called on their citizens to leave Ukraine immediately. The U.S. State Department has even ordered its non-emergency embassy staff in Ukraine to leave. The Pentagon also says it is withdrawing nearly all of its remaining soldiers from Ukraine amid rising tensions between Moscow and Washington. The Russian military said a U.S. submarine violated its waters near the Kuril Islands in the Far East as Russia was conducting naval exercises. The military said it used, quote, appropriate means to make the intruding vessel leave after it ignored a request. Russia's defense ministry has summoned the U.S. military attaché over the incident. Political commentator Mr. John Bosnich says Russia has reiterated that it is not planning on invading Ukraine, and if the U.S. and the West are worried about an invasion, they should provide evidence for such a concern.
There's no justification for statements about an attack coming in 1 hour or 3 hours or tomorrow afternoon or anything like that. If this is what the United States and its NATO allies are trying to do, to incite fear in their own populations, then that's what they're achieving. But of that fear, nothing good can come. Russia has been making it very, very clear that they're not planning to invade. If the West is that worried about an invasion, then maybe they should prove the evidence that they're using to make those claims. The people of the region on both sides are all the victims of current pre-warfare psychological operations. But the far more damaging and unsettling operation is the one being conducted by the United States and its NATO allies, who are goading the war on, who are threatening a war at any moment, and yet saying that they will not intervene in any way. So these elements are definitely stoking the fires of war. And since war is the main business for most of the NATO countries, the military-industrial complex is the main business, then they're just stoking the fires of their own economy at the expense of the Russians and of the Ukrainian, ethnic Ukrainians and ethnic Russians in the country of Ukraine.
The U.S. says it is offering more security and diplomatic resources to the Pacific region in a bid to counter what it regards as China's growing influence there. Washington has also confirmed the reopening of its embassy in the Solomon Islands after nearly three decades. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed these developments with our guests.
Hey, And now welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. The United States says it will reopen its embassy on the Solomon Islands as Washington seeks to expand its presence in the Pacific region. Washington has not had an embassy there since 1993 and is represented by a consulate, which is directed from the U.S. Embassy in Papua New Guinea. Senior U.S. officials have said the move is aimed at countering China's growing influence in the Pacific. They say Beijing plans to forge military ties in the region. In December, China said it'll send police advisors and non-lethal gear to the Solomon Islands following deadly riots a month earlier. The U.S. Secretary of State is now in Fiji for talks with regional leaders. Washington is promising more diplomatic and security sources to Pacific nations. Joining us now is Andrew Lang, independent China specialist from Hong Kong, for more on the story, along with Mr. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Hope you're safe and doing well, both of you. I guess we'll start there in Hong Kong with you, Mr. Lang. Tell us what the U.S. is trying to do with its increasing presence in the Pacific.
I think there is a perception that China, quite unlike the past century, is now growing in global influence. It's expanding its influence around the world, competing with the United States' global reach. Secondly, the global China's global reach is now encroaching on the United States' traditional sphere of influence, including its backyard. For example, recently, even Argentina in South America has joined the Belt and Road Initiative. Apart from China's diplomatic and other economic relations with a number of South African countries, and now the Asia-Pacific has felt that China's influence is growing. Thirdly, China is now competing not only with the United States in economics, on the military, South China Sea, but also increasingly in soft power. The Beijing Olympics, the Winter Olympics and the Beijing Olympics, Summer Olympics were examples. And of course, the Solomon Island, unlike the United States, China is not prepared or is not able to replicate the Americans' global reach. Americans' military bases in many, many countries around the world. There's no sense that China would repeat that. But by growing its influence in the Asia-Pacific, along with the Belt and Road, along with investments, or given police help, it also strokes the kind of feeling that China's approach is very different. Americans' approach is all military, coercion, sanctions, and trying to force or coerce other countries to play to Americans' hymn book.
Your thoughts, what's the Washington's rule here, Mr. Jones, that you can be nowhere in our neighborhood, but we could be in your backyard when it comes to Russia, when it comes to China?
Well, Secretary Blinken went to Asia with was a document that was released by the White House yesterday on the Indo-Pacific strategy. And if you looked at this in detail, it's really a declaration of empire. It's worded in, of course, different terms, talking about their alliances and their similarity in values, et cetera, et cetera. But essentially, it's telling the Asia-Pacific powers that that we are the big cheese in the Asia-Pacific, and you've got to ally with us if you really want to go anywhere. They have nothing to offer them except military equipment, similar to what was done with the AUKUS. But they also have to say certain things about that they also will do infrastructure. They also will send their vaccines. They're really following in China's wake on all of these issues in order to try and regain some credibility in the region.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. Always a pleasure to speak to both of you. Andrew Lang from Hong Kong and Mr. William Jones joining us from the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. A standoff between the Canadian police and anti-vaccine protesters continues In the capital, Ottawa, authorities say those who do not respect the rule of law will get arrested. The warning comes hours after the start of an operation by the police to end the protesters' blockade on the Ambassador Bridge, the country's busiest border crossing with the United States. Truckers have cut access to three vital Canadian-U.S. crossings in protest at or against the government's COVID restrictions and vaccine mandates. The presidents of the U.S. and Canada have called for an end to the blockade, and a judge has ruled accordingly. Canadian officials say security officers have been deployed to some other areas, including the city of Toronto and New Brunswick province, to avoid similar unrest. France's Yellow Vests, led an anti-government quote-unquote freedom convoy to Paris, taking a page from the book of protesters in Canada. However, Paris responded with an immediate crackdown, it's not clear if France's freedom convoy is finished or if it's only just begun. Romain Mazoheri has more.
Tens of thousands of people marched nationwide while an estimated 3,000 cars converged in Paris for a freedom convoy emulating the anti-government movement in Ottawa. The convoy was led by France's Yellow Vests, who resumed their Saturday marches in October and also included some of the long-running protesters against a vaccination smart pass so strict it's been called a de facto vaccine mandate. Equally important for protesters was expressing long-running disapproval of President Emmanuel Macron and his right-wing socioeconomic policies.
The price of gas is killing us. It's all become too much for us to accept. If we keep letting things go, where is France going to end up?
France responded by flooding Paris with over 7,000 police, who waged yet another violent crackdown on peaceful protests. Dozens were arrested, hundreds of fines were issued, tear gas was constant on the famed Champs-Élysées Avenue, and cars were impounded.
I came here from Bordeaux. The government responds with violence because they have nothing else to offer, and this is why the French do not understand them. I do not think the French are stupid. They want to understand. All we want is some answers to our many questions on policy.
In order to prevent the Freedom Convoy from implanting itself, the capital was locked down in many areas, something which Paris saw every Saturday for over 6 months in late 2018 and early 2019.
We marched as Yellow Vests for 2 years, and we are still Yellow Vests today. We all saw that nothing changed. The cost of living is too expensive. We can pay our bills at the end of the month. We don't want this government and the violence anymore.
The Freedom Convoy may have already wrested a concession. The government announced plans to abolish the pass at the end of March. Many called the timing curious, as that would be just before voters first go to the polls on April 10th. Protesters say they expect more attempts at an Ottawa-style freedom convoy, no matter how repressed by the government this one has been. It's possible the French election campaign of 2022 has just begun. Romain Mazaheri, Paris.
Thousands of Venezuelans hit the streets of the capital, Caracas, to voice support for President Nicolas Maduro. The demonstrators chanted pro-government slogans and carried the photos of Maduro. They marched on a 14-kilometer course to mark World Youth Day, which traditionally brings out all Venezuelan parties to the streets. Opposition figure Juan Guaido, also attended a small gathering of the Venezuelan opposition and delivered a speech. Talks between Iran and the P4+1, a group of countries, continue in Vienna as the sides intensify their efforts to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. The head of the Chinese delegation says there is a consensus the negotiations are heading in their final stage. Wang Chun says Iran has presented its final proposition to the other parties. A source close to the talks has told Press TV that Tehran views the act of exchanging proposals as a normal practice in any negotiation. The source says Iran has put forward new ideas on the table and is encouraging other parties to do the same. The source also told us that Tehran has a clear mandate in the Vienna talks and that developments outside the scope of the negotiations will not have any effect on Tehran's stance. Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 agreement are conducting the eighth round of discussions in the Austrian capital aimed at reviving the JCPOA. Our Vienna-based correspondent Homolezgi joined us earlier with more details on the eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal.
It looks like among the remaining outstanding issues, one of the issues that still needs to be resolved is Iran's nuclear capabilities and achievements, specifically when it comes to Iran's research and development activities. However, it will not back down, it says, on its right when it comes to research and development. Now, just to give you the latest on the process here in Vienna, we're seeing a lot of diplomatic activity recently. Today, we're hearing that the Iranian team has been engaged in lengthy and intensive negotiations, both with the EU coordinator, Enrico Mora, with the Russians. Mr. Bagley had a meeting, and later today, we're expecting him to have more meetings still. Mikhail Ulyanov, the Russian lead delegate here, following his meeting with Bagheri, said that they had discussed in details the way ahead, and he also referred to his separate meeting with U.S. Special Envoy Rob Malley, saying that they had discussed the contentious issues which need to be settled. What are they? One is, of course, on the nuclear field we just mentioned, but the other issues pertain to the sanctions removal or the sanctions lifting, both when it comes to the scope of sanctions and also when it comes to verification and guarantees.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new report from the Americans for Tax Fairness, ATF, estimates that $21 trillion of debt wealth will pass internally within America's already dynastically wealthy families between now and 2045, says Chuck Collins, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "The Dynastic Wealth of U.S. Oligarchs is a Threat to Democracy." Stay tuned for more. There is an understandable focus on new wealth technology billionaires like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, especially as their wealth surges during the pandemic. But it is equally important to understand how multi-generational wealth dynasties are deploying dynasty trust and other elaborate tax dodges to sequester trillions in Dutch inheritance taxes. Wealth managers have pointed to a substantial intergenerational transfer of wealth, recently estimated at $68 trillion, as baby boomers pass on wealth to the next generations. But most of this wealth is passing within the upper canopy of the wealth forest between the already wealthy and their heirs. A new report from the Americans for Tax Fairness, ATF, estimates that $21 trillion of debt wealth will pass internally within America's already dynastically wealthy families between now and 2045. The report, Dynasty Trust, Giant Tax Loopholes That Supercharge Wealth Accumulation, estimates that these wealthy families will avoid as much as $8.4 trillion in estate and generation skipping taxes between now and 2024 by using Dynasty Trust and other currently legal loopholes, assuming current estate tax rules. Dynasty trust is a term for a variety of wealth accumulating structures that remain in place for multiple generations to ensure their fortunes cascades down to children, grandchildren, and beyond, undiminished by wealth transfer taxes. They typically are employed by estates of $10 million or more. The ATF report points out that the $8.4 trillion sum, an average of $350 billion a year over 24 years, is equivalent to the cost of over four Build Back Better plans costing $1.75 trillion each over 10 years. About half of the $8.4 trillion is equivalent to the cost of 24 years of expanded child tax credit CTC that was included in the House-passed BBB bill and is estimated to reduce childhood poverty by 40%. The expanded CTC cost about $1.6 trillion over 10 years, or roughly $160 billion a year. The report describes the activities of the wealth defense industry, the tax attorneys, accountants, and wealth managers who are paid millions to hide trillions on behalf of their wealthy clients. The choice is clear, the report declares, adding, "We can fix our broken estate and gift tax system and stop the concentration of an ever larger share of America's wealth inside enormous dynasty trust, or we can trust our democracy to a handful of trillionaires. Trust fund babies." The report underscores the warnings from an June 2021 IPS report, Silver Spoon Oligarchs, How America's 50 Largest Inherited Wealth Dynasties Accelerate Inequality. Without reforming estate and gift tax laws, the United States will continue to see the concentration of wealth within several hundred ultra-high net worth families forming oligarchic power blocks. History buffs will enjoy the sections of the new ATF report that traces the history of U.S. wealth transfer taxation from Teddy Roosevelt's 1910 clarion call for an estate tax that increased rapidly in amount with the size of the state and was properly safeguarded against evasion. The report further documents the aggressive moves of estate planners to diminish or zero out tax liabilities and the usually delayed and often ineffective efforts by IRS to block their ploys. For example, many of the loopholes deployed by the ultra-wealthy artificially depress the value of family assets for tax purposes and create trust that enable families to aggressively avoid estate and gift taxes. This allows for virtually unlimited intergenerational transfers of wealth from one generation to the next. Tax avoidance isn't the only concern, as these oligarchic concentrations of wealth and power pose political threats to our democratic system. A recent ATF report on billionaire campaign contributions found that U.S. billionaires made a combined $1.2 billion in political contributions in the 2020 election cycle, 10% of all campaign contributions.
Food for thought. everyone, and congratulations on the birthday anniversary of the Holy Prophet's 9th infallible heir, Imam Muhammad Taqi, also known as Imam Javad, peace be upon him. Let us listen to his wise words regarding real peace and prosperity in the brief life of this transient world. We are only lading from this world. He who belief and religion are the same as his acquaintance will surely accompany that acquaintance everywhere. The life to come is surely the lasting abode.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Brothers and sisters, when talking about the different levels of human soul or nafs, we need to know those stations and those levels to understand our own faculties as human beings, to understand what we can do to move from one level to another. That is a very important thing. The process of achieving perfection requires that we understand the faculties of the soul, the dangers of falling into quagmires. Of course, in the previous episode, I gave a general overview of the levels of nafs, and also I stressed on the importance and the need for our and self-knowledge and also knowledge of nafs and the faculties that actually man has. And these capacities are partially dormant, and those capacities must be, or those potentialities must be awakened. Now I would like to acquaint you with the different levels of nafs or self. You know, as I told you, the word nafs has been translated into English in different ways, some using the word self, some others using the word nafs. Now, the word nafs, as far as I know, many Muslims understand what nafs is, at least the exact translation. So, brothers and sisters, to begin, the scholars have divided the nafs into various levels and have given different names to these levels. These names are derived from the Quranic verses. To begin with, we have the following levels and the following names that have been given to nafs. And the first step that we have, or the first level of nafs, is the nafs-e ammara, or the evil commanding self. That nafs which commands to evil, nafs-e ammara, because ammara comes from amr, and then there is some sort of exaggeration or emphasis in the word. So nafs which commands to the evil, to the sin, to indecency, that is called nafs-e ammara. This is the first level. Then we have nafs-e lawama, the blaming self, the reproaching self, or the accusing self. And then we have nafs-e mutma'inna, which is the secure self. And we have the inspired self, nafs-e mulhima. And then nafs-e radhiya, the content self. And nafs-e mardhiya, the gratified self. Nafs-e safiya, the complete self. There are different names given to the different stages and the different levels of nafs. I'm pretty sure that we will not be able to explore these different types of nafs in more detail and give you explanation of what they exactly are. As far as we can, we will try to explore and discuss some of these levels based on what I have learned from my teachers and also from the books I have read. For example, late Allama Tabatabai's Tafsir al-Mizan, because as I said, these different levels of nafs are derived from the Quranic verses, and I will give you some verses of the Quran to tell you that these, for example, that a given verse points to a given level of nafs. Now, when it comes to the first level of nafs, the Quran says, "Inna nafsa la ammaratun bisu." Now, chapter Yusuf, verse 53. Most surely, man's self, man's nafs, wound to command him to do evil. In other words, man's nafs is in the habit of commanding him to evil. This first level of the development of man, I should term it, the rational self in human conscience have been overtaken by carnal desires. Carnal desires are there, and those desires actually govern man's mind, man's body, and commands him. In other words, the nafs-e ammara, or the carnal desires. Now, at this stage, our self does not recognize the rational or moral limits on the way to achieve what it wants. Now, this first level expresses itself in selfishness, in arrogance, hardness of heart, and oppression of others, lack of gratitude. And also this first level of nafs-e ammara actually expresses itself or manifests itself in ambition, in stinginess, envy, anger, laziness, every ugliness or carnal desires could be there. And they are the things that govern the human mind, the human body, and the human action. And it is the lowest level of self, according to Urafa or according to Muslim scholars. And in this level, there is an extreme desire for immortality. Brothers and sisters, the self, the nafs on this level is attached to the worst of characteristics against which we have been warned by Allah and His prophets. For instance, self-admiration, arrogance, pride, hardness of the heart, oppression of creatures, fondness for exposing the faults of other people, lying, gossip, backbiting, envy, jealousy, criticism, you know, and undeserved self-praise, bitterness, attachment to what belongs to others, even if it possesses something better, and lack of contentment, constant complaining, lack of gratitude, blindness to blessings, and wishing for increase without effort, extreme selfishness, greed, and covetousness that knows no limit, love of control and love of self and its desires, hatred for those who criticize it, even if it is for its own good, and love for those who praise it, even if it is in hypocrisy, rejection of advice and counsel, and only talking about itself. These are the mean and the despicable characteristics that are there. Not all of them could be there at the same time, but some of them may be there. But these are the stages of the lower self, the base stage. Let's have a break. We will be back.
Changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome to your program for a better life. We are discussing Ma'rifat al-Nafs, self-knowledge. Originally, the nafs, the false ego, was one of the Creator's gifts to men, one of the Lord's gifts to men. But because we allow the nafs to lean towards material values, to take pleasure only in the worldly life, our nafs has become almost animal-like, while its shape remains that of a human being. This nafs is our worst enemy, who is living inside us, dominating and tyrannizing us, and keeping our human soul imprisoned and forgotten in the depths of our subconscious. And of course, to make a long story short, I would suffice to saying that when we rid ourselves from base desires, the lower self, the nafs that commands us to evil, then we may rise to the second level, which is called nafs al-lawama, the blaming self. And thus the soul is pulled out from the dark dungeon of the ego to the light of conscience, and we will see our arrogance being transformed into humility, vengefulness and hate into love, anger into kindness, lust into chastity. And of course, this transition will definitely take place once we rise to the second level. Brothers and sisters, that's all for this session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows.
10 minutes.
Some say that he does have ties to Muslim extremists. I don't know.
As the talks continued between Tehran and the P4 plus one group of countries, Israel's voice of agony grows louder. Israel has launched a pressure campaign to make sure that the countries negotiating with Iran in Vienna do not agree to what Israeli officials call a bad deal, meaning a deal that allows Tehran to make nuclear bombs. The very idea of building a nuclear bomb is totally rejected by the Iranian government. In 2003, Iran's leader issued a fatwa that forbade the production and use of any form of weapon of mass destruction, which includes nuclear weapons. However, accusing Iran of going after the nukes is a strategy Israel uses to legitimize its hostile stance against Iran. The regime has even beefed up its military activities. In November, Israeli, Emirati and Bahraini naval forces, for the first time, rehearsed joint security operations with the US warship. A month earlier, Israel launched a war game at a desert airbase just north of the port city of Eilat, which sent fighter planes from the occupied territories and seven other countries roaring into the skies. Israel also allocated $1.5 billion to prepare the Israeli armed forces for a potential strike against Iran nuclear sites. In fact, there are near daily warnings from Israeli political and military officials as well. In the latest move in a series of threats, Israel's Minister of War Affairs ordered his forces to prepare a military option. Benny Gantz warned the world that Israel would take matters into its own hands if a nuclear agreement did not constrain Iran the way Israel wants it to.
Recently, the chief of staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. The Iranian nuclear aspiration must be stalled. If the world stops them before, it's very much good. But if not, we must stand independently and we must defend ourselves by ourselves.
What Gantz said could be interpreted as a direct threat. However, there are multiple military experts in and outside Israel who believe Gantz's statement was nothing but an empty threat. Several current and former senior Israeli military officials and experts say that Israel lacks the ability to attack Iran. Military experts say Tel Aviv can't pull off an assault that could destroy or even significantly delay Iran's nuclear program, at least not anytime soon. Now, one might ask why carrying out an assault on Iran would be impossible, given the fact that Israel has the latest military weaponry, fighter jets, and support of the United States. True, Israel has a long history when it comes to air attacks, but it won't be as easy as it was when it bombed Egypt, Gaza, Iraq, Lebanon, Sudan, Tunisia, and Syria. Not easy, at least, without potentially catastrophic consequences. To be sure, one could not compare Israel's bombing of such facilities in Iran to its air attacks against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981 or Syria's Al-Kubar facility in 2007. Relek Shafir, a retired Israeli Air Force general who was a pilot in a 1981 strike on an Iraqi nuclear facility, said, "Bombing Iran's nuclear facility is almost impossible." Iran has dozens of nuclear sites, some deep underground, that would be hard for Israeli bombs to quickly penetrate and destroy. The fact is, the Israeli Air Force does not have warplanes large enough to carry such large bombs, so the more protected sites would have to be struck repeatedly with less effective missiles, a process that might take days or even weeks. The other obstacle is geography. If Israel decides to carry out strikes on Iran, its warplanes must fly over 3,000 kilometers to get to Iran. This would cause fuel shortages as the planes have to fly the same amount to go back to Israel. Israel has already ordered jets that can make such flights at a cost of $2.4 billion, but the aircraft are backordered and Israel is unlikely to receive even one before late 2024. There's also the fear of retaliation. Naturally, if Iran gets attacked, it will respond vehemently. Some Israeli planes would almost certainly be lost during the sorties. Their pilots would be killed or taken prisoner, and such losses would have huge consequences for Israel. Let's not forget that Iran is a country of nearly 86 million people, with the potential ability to mobilize its networks all over the Middle East to retaliate. From Lebanon to Palestine and Syria, pro-Iranian forces surrounding Israel could make the regime pay a huge price for any attack. Israel's famous missile system is no good for such a confrontation either. The Iron Dome was never tested in a real battle. It only intercepted man-made Gazan rockets, not real missiles or rockets. It's not even capable of intercepting those handcrafted missiles coming from Gaza. So, if a war erupts, it is safe to say that the Iron Dome can't be much of a help to Israelis. In the meantime, Iran has a formidable missile arsenal of its own capable of precision strikes, which can easily respond to an Israeli bombing of its nuclear sites by going after softer targets.
They always shoot at Israel rockets, but in 2004 or 5, people start to get killed. Make me very annoyed that we don't have a solution. And also, I remember even 91, when Iraq shoot missiles in Israel, we have no solution. You know, everything was, Tel Aviv was empty, okay? They shoot around Tel Aviv. And I decided that we have to do something. Although nothing had been done around the world and everybody said it cannot be done.
One doesn't need to be a general or a strategist to find out that the declarations by the Israeli officials about Israel's readiness for a military strike are empty and pointless rhetoric. All you need is to look at the past few decades. Since January 1995, Israel has been saying that Iran is much closer to producing nuclear weapons than previously thought and could be less than 5 years away from having an atomic bomb. 27 years later, Israel continues threatening to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. And yet nothing. It's quite clear. Israel is just playing pretend.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Pfizer has projected that it will generate a record-shattering $32 billion in revenue from its publicly funded coronavirus vaccine in 2022, as the U.S. pharmaceutical giant refuses to share its technology with other nations. leaving billions of people around the world without access to life-saving shots as the pandemic continues to rage. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading Pfizer forecast record-breaking 2022 profits as billions remain unprotected. Stay tuned for the details, please. Pfizer has projected that it will generate a record-shattering $32 billion in revenue from its publicly funded coronavirus vaccine in 2022, as the U.S. pharmaceutical giant refuses to share its technology with other nations, leaving billions of people around the world without access to life-saving shots as the pandemic continues to rage. The UK-based advocacy group Global Justice Now said Big Pharma has made more than enough money from this crisis. It's time to suspend patents and break vaccine monopolies. While a portion of Pfizer's mRNA-based vaccine recipe was leaked last year, the pharmaceutical firm and its German partner, BioNTech, have closely guarded the details of their manufacturing process, allowing the companies to rake in huge profits by selling their COVID-19 shots at a price tag well above the cost of production. Recently, Pfizer reported that its profits increased roughly fourfold to $3.4 billion in the fourth quarter of 2021, beating analysts' expectations. It's nothing short of pandemic profiteering for Pfizer to make a killing while its vaccines have been whittled from so many, Tim Bearley, a pharma campaigner at Global Justice Now, said in a statement, adding, Pfizer is now richer than most countries. It has made more than enough money from this crisis. In an analysis published in July, the People's Vaccine Alliance noted that Pfizer, BioNTech, are charging their lowest reported price of $6.75 per dose to the African Union. But this is still nearly six times more than the estimated potential production cost of this vaccine. The coalition observed one dose of the vaccine costs the same as Uganda spends per citizen on health in a whole year. To date, according to the World Health Organization, just 11% of the 1.3 billion people on the African continent have been fully vaccinated against the COVID-19. The development of mRNA vaccines should have revolutionized the global COVID response, Global Justice Now told The Independent recently, adding, but we've left Pfizer with all this essential medical innovation from much of the world, all while ripping off public health systems with an eye-watering markup. Pfizer's fourth quarter and full-year earnings report for 2021 was released recently as the coronavirus pandemic remains a deadly force worldwide, killing an average of 10,600 people each day as rich countries with plentiful vaccine supply continue to lift public health restrictions and move on from the crisis. Meanwhile, poor countries that have been denied the resources necessary to produce vaccines at home struggle to fend off the virus and its fast-spreading mutations. According to the latest figures from Our World in Data, a mere 10.4% of people in low-income countries have received at least one coronavirus vaccine dose 2 years into the pandemic. Pfizer has charged huge markups on its vaccine, scaremongered about vaccine hesitancy in low-income countries, lobbied against those same countries making their own vaccines, and is now profiting handsomely. What a business model, Birley tweeted sardonically recently. In October 2020, South Africa and India pushed members of the World Trade Organization, WTO, to adopt a patent waiver that would let lower-income countries produce generic coronavirus vaccines without fear of legal retribution by the pharmaceutical industry. Predictably, Pfizer, Moderna, and other corporations lobbied aggressively against the measure, which remains stalled due to the opposition of Germany, the UK, and other wealthy WTO members. The Biden administration, which endorsed the patent waiver last May, has faced growing calls to use all legal tools at its disposal to force Pfizer and other U.S.-based vaccine makers to share their recipes with the world, but it has yet to do so. Without the support of rich country governments or the pharmaceutical industry, scientists in South Africa have begun the process of replicating Moderna's mRNA vaccine in the hopes of making the shot globally accessible and ending vaccine apartheid. Charles Gore, executive director of the UN-backed medicines patent pool, said this can be a game changer.
Iran's civil aviation industry was one of the first sectors to be restricted and sanctioned during the first days of the Islamic Revolution of 1979. As the scope of the sanctions expanded in the following years, the development of this industry was slowed down to an extent that some of the neighboring countries that had founded their aviation industry decades after Iran got ahead. Despite the pressure on it and the loss of money and lives due to the existing demand in the country and the support given by the government, Iran's aviation industry was able to survive and continue its activities. Now, the question that comes to mind is how an industry which was completely imported from outside not only remained in business but also achieved growth. How were they able to purchase airplanes? How did Iran find the professional human resources and specialists? Do international regulations match the sanctions imposed on the industry? In an industry which the life cycle of all parts and equipment are inspected under international regulations, how did Iran get the spare parts and certificates needed to continue to work? When the Iran nuclear deal was signed in 2015, what opportunities opened to the industry?
The JCPOA for aviation was not fair play. They designed a very dirty play against the aviation industry of Iran.
This is an inside story of efforts made to keep this very modern industry running, despite the harsh sanctions levied against Iran. Iran's aviation industry. With the establishment of companies such as Iranian Airways and Persian Air Services in the 1940s, Iran's civil aviation industry began its work. However, the official start of this industry in Iran dates back to the year 1962. On February 24 of that year, the government ordered the merger of Iran Airways and Persian Air Services, establishing the Iranian National Airline, or Iran Air, as a state-run flag carrier air service company.